So I'm going to be talking about this paper I wrote recently called Holography Without Strings. And if we can advance to the next slide, I'll tell you a little bit about it. So this discussion about gauge gravity duality and an attempt to probe a little bit further into how it works from the Holger point of view. I guess I'm getting my own voice through your microphone is what I'm hearing.
I turned it on. Is that better?
Let me try. That's a bit better. Yeah. Okay, I'll try to keep talking and ignore that. It's slightly distracting, but I'll work with it. So it's an attempt to probe what makes gauge gravity duality tick kind of from the Holger point of view. Now, that's kind of a nebulous question with a long history of discussion. So a point maybe to try to focus on is, what is the role of strings in gauge gravity duality? Certainly for the sort of most understood versions of gauge gravity duality or examples thereof, the dual theory is a gauge theory, and that fact is certainly intimately tied with the presence of strings in the bulk. At least the fact that gauge theory is an important observables formed by Wilson loops is clearly connected to the existence of strings in the bulk and makes them a strong tie. But one can try to ask further whether strings are really, really important for the essence of holography, whatever that would mean. And, you know, one could therefore try to probe even further and say, if we have a complete theory of quantum gravity in the bulk, which in bulk anti de Sitter space, say, which is not a string, should it have a good holographic dual? Now, there's a history of discussion of this subject. I know of relatively few actual published papers commenting directly on this, but there are probably lots of references I don't know. I've mentioned a few in blue here, but if people in the audience have suggestions for further references I should add, I'd love to receive them, especially by email after the talk is complete. But basically, the plan of this talk is to kind of review a general discussion that's out there in the literature or in the community, and then to add a specific new technical point that will take me a while to introduce. So half of this talk is kind of general review of known facts, and there's a particular technical extension that I will get to after appropriate motivation. All right. Let's go on to the next slide. So the first question, of course, is what property are we trying to reproduce? What do we mean by a holographic theory? After all, we learned, say, from Witten long ago, that if we have any local bulk theory, let's say an anti de Sitter space, just to be definite, or asymptotically anti de Sitter space. No, let's start with a theory in exact anti de Sitter space that might be just a scalar field theory. We learned that if we have such an ADS invariant bulk theory, that in some sense defines a conformal field theory by looking at appropriately rescaled boundary limits of the bulk operators. So I've written down an equation you can look at. If we have a bulk theory, maybe of scalars, and the bulk operators are called phi, then you can define boundary operators that I've called here beta by scaling them by a power of Pfefferman-Cram coordinate as you take the limit as the points approach the boundary. And then just the ADS isometries tell you that these correlators of these betas are conformally invariant. All right. Well, okay, that's a true fact. Any bulk theory that's ADS invariant defines the CFT in this sense. By itself, it's not really all that exciting. Let's go on to the next slide, which makes an additional comment. The additional comment is that there is a sense in which even for just scalar field theories in the bulk, this correspondence, sort of trivial correspondence I just discussed, is actually duality. That is to say, it's certainly true that if you consider free scalar field theories, all of bulk information in the bulk field phi can be recovered from the full set of boundary operators beta. And in fact, that statement about the free theory can be extended order by order to bulk perturbation theory. I've listed some papers on the left that have sort of taught us this story. I should mention that by itself, it also does not deserve the name holography. It's just solving the bulk equation for motion in some sense, using a radial initial value problem. Okay, and I'll remind you that there are two different ways it works. Say, in the case of a free scalar field, in the free scalar field, maybe the most elementary way to see that this works is to just work in Fourier space. In Fourier space, or in a mode decomposition, all equation of motion means that the radial momenta are entirely determined by the momenta along the boundary, the frequency in the time direction, and the spatial momenta along the boundary. And because these boundary operators beta do not satisfy an equation of motion, they have the same number of independent Fourier coefficients as the bulk field. And so you can recover the bulk field mode by mode via Fourier transform of its boundary degrees. A slightly more elegant version of this construction is due to Hamilton, Cabot, Lifshitz, and Lowe, which uses what's called a space-like Green's function, which you can show exists for these massive scalar fields in global anti-de Sitter space. I've drawn a little picture of it here. If you're trying to reconstruct a bulk scalar field in free theory, located at this dark blue dot, you can write it using a Green's function that has support only in a kind of space-like form. And so you can show that that data can be recovered from data in boundary operators beta within some finite interval of time along the ATS map. And again, that map can be corrected perfectly for interacting fields in bulk. So this is just to remind you that there is this, I would still say, trivial notion of duality in the sense that all the bulk information recovered from the boundary, but it really is trivial. It happens for all bulk theories of any reasonable type, and so even this doesn't merit the name holography. We want some additional property. And what do we want? Well, we can see pretty quickly why this is not an interesting notion of holography. It's because in this case, these boundary operators beta are, well, by definition, just the boundary values of the bulk field. So if we look at dynamics of the theory, of course, dynamics will cause information to be exchanged between the boundary and the bulk. In other words, if we start with a configuration where the bulk theory is trivial near the boundary at some one time on a surface of constant t, okay, that means that for this conformal field theory, we're sort of starting it in its exact vacuum. But if the bulk is non-trivial in some region deep in the interior, then after some time, that propagates out to the boundary, and the CFT sees the result. So we would be describing something that we formally call a conformal field theory, but it has the property that you could start with something exactly the vacuum, and at some in the future, which is not predictable from the initial conditions, it transforms into some non-vacuum state. In other words, this notion of a dual CFT does not have a self-contained dynamics. It doesn't have anything like an equation of motion. The CFT itself is not what you would call unitary. Okay? What's true here is that the full set of beta operators over all times on the boundary allow you to reconstruct everything in the bulk. But if you consider these beta operators behind what we have tended to call the CFT at one particular time on one slice of the boundary, those contain only a tiny fraction of information in the bulk. Okay? So that's why I would say that this does not merit the name of a holography. All right. Any questions about that? All right, let's go on to the next slide then. Okay. What we want to really use the term holography is to have some sort of dual CFT with a self-contained dynamics, let's say as a unitary dynamics. So, to state that for one, we might say we want a CFT wave function to contain complete information at each time. Or equivalently, we might say we want the CFT observables at any one time to contain complete information. Now, we should stop for a minute and think about what that means from the bulk point of view and ask, does this in fact mean that what we want for a holographic bulk, does it mean that for a holographic bulk we necessarily want the boundary limits of bulk observables contain complete information at each time t. Well, I can give you one quick argument that that is what we want. Okay, in principle, it's a logically separate question from whether the CFT observables are complete. It's related to the question of, are all, is a complete set of CFT observables given by boundary limits of bulk fields? So an argument, one argument, this is the property we want for the bulk, comes by looking at known examples. In the known examples, the dual conformal field theories are gauge theories, or things that are much like them. And in that context, we know from, say, a lattice description that space-like Wilson loops in the gauge theory and their time derivatives together form a complete set of observables at each time. Okay? And we expect that space-like Wilson loops are related to strings near the boundary in the bulk. So this maybe suggests that what we do want from holography is some setting where the boundary limits of bulk observables contain complete information at each time, although when I phrase it, it again suggests that maybe strings are playing a central role in this correspondence. As some of you may know, I'm going to argue in a minute this is not the case and the strings don't really play. So let's go to my next slide. This argument about strings and completeness of Wilson loops is not really essential to the property that I want. The property that I wanted is for the dual field theory, or maybe from the bulk perspective, the set of boundary limits of bulk observables, boundary observables, to have some self-contained dynamics. Okay. Well, what does that mean? It means that I should be able to write down an equation like the one I've written here that expresses where if O is a maybe boundary limit bulk observable at one time, I'd like to be able to in terms of boundary limits observables at a different time. And I can do that if I can write an equation like this, where H also formed from boundary limits of bulk observables. Okay? In that case, which is time independent, I would have succeeded in writing the left hand side, the boundary limit of a bulk observable at a late time, in terms of boundary limits of bulk observables at early times. All right. So we make the observation that, of course, you can do that in any bulk theory which has the normal property we associate with gravity in the Hamiltonian formalism. That is to say, you can do this, that the it is true in any gravitational theory, which is diffeomorphism invariant, that the analog of the ADM Hamiltonian is a boundary term on shell, and in that sense, you can formally write the equation I've written here, which suggests that there is a self-contained dynamics to the boundary observables. Okay, so here is a suggestion that perhaps the only property we really need for the bulk theory is massless gravity in the bulk, normal gravity with a Hamiltonian constraint, and a Hamiltonian, which on shell is just a boundary term. Okay, let's for a moment contrast that with the previous argument. The previous argument about Wilson loops and the gauge theory was really the statement that you expect that space-like Wilson loops are complete in the gauge theory. If we did this in the dual field theory when it is a gauge theory, we could take the right-hand side of my equation and write it out in some sense explicitly as a sum of Wilson loops. It's worth reflecting, though, on how explicitly that can be done. There is some sense in which it's true on the lattice, although, of course, computing the explicit form is a nightmare. But take ultraviolet cutoff to zero, as you remove the lattice regulator, that sum becomes nastier and nastier. It turns out, I am told, that this involves wigglier and wigglier Wilson loops, as shown in the picture on the screen, which have structure on arbitrarily small scales. There's always structure on the lattice scale or the cutoff scale. And so it's not at all clear that this formal expression as a sum of loops has any meaning which is more than formal in the continuum limit. At least it's not clear to me. Another issue, if you take the point of view that this writing out right-hand side in terms of relative loops is of fundamental importance is that he doesn't really seem to clarify what's going on with holography. That is to say, there may be some formal sense in which, sorry, let's do it this way. Let's imagine we're thinking about an operator in the bulk which is fairly well local. Let's start by thinking about localized excitation in the bulk, which might be created by as a local operator in the bulk. Here I'm going to gloss over the fact that in quantum gravity theory there aren't really any local operators. So imagine that we're thinking about what happens near this black dot that I've shown in the center of anti-center space. Then, as I said before, if you solve the equations of motion by evolving this forward in time, you could express what looks like a local field operator, localized near this field, this black dot, in terms of the boundary values of fields at later times. You could then use this evolution equation along the boundary to sort of take all this boundary data and squash it down to one particular time on the boundary. So this suggests that you could write the localized operator in the center of ADS as some kind of formal sum of Wilson loops in the gauge theory all at one time. Okay? And maybe that's true, but it still leaves a mystery of how a sum of Wilson loops in the gauge theory, each of which we think of as being related to strings that live near the boundary of ADS, it leaves a mystery how that could possibly be related to a localized deep in the ball. We didn't clarify this mystery at all. On the other hand, if I don't worry about the Wilson loops and I just take this formula at the top of the screen as given, well, I think it's clear how that works. It's what I said a minute ago. If you have a localized excitation in the bulk, say at the black dot, what this is saying is that the bulk dynamics cause the information at that black dot to disperse and eventually to hit the boundary at some late time. And what we're really doing is we want to write a local operator in the bulk in terms of boundary operators at some one fixed time. If we first solve the bulk equations of motion to express the localized operator in terms of boundary data, that does not involve the equation at the top of the screen. We then use the equation at the top of the screen to do what I said a minute ago, just compress all this boundary data down to one particular time. That seemed like a very straightforward explanation. All right, so that's my question of why strings may not be playing a fundamental role in the duality, and why bulk gravity may be the essential object in this story. I guess I should pause if there are any questions. All right, let's go on to the next slide. Okay, so just to repeat a few of the well-known facts, this suggests that if you had any UV-complete theory of bulk gravity, it would be holographic in the same way, at least as long as that bulk gravity theory had a Hamiltonian that was on shell of pure boundary terms. As most students will know, this kind of structure of bulk gravity naturally gives you not only a Hamiltonian for the CFT, but also a bulk stress tensor by the usual construction of varying the action with respect to the boundary metric. It also gives you other natural properties for the CFT, or appears to. For example, at least at leading semi-classical order in the bulk, it ensures that boundary observables, which are space-like separated along the boundary, commute. Okay? This follows from old work by Gao and Wald, the classical limit, assuming the weak energy condition in the bulk, or you can give a semi-classical argument based on the generalized second law following Aaron Wald. The point is that either of these starting points allow you to conclude that if you want to connect two points on the boundary via some causal curve through the bulk, the fastest causal curves actually lie on the boundary. That is to say that if two points on the boundary are space, if two points on the boundary are space-like separated according to the induced causal structure of the boundary, then they are also space-like separated through the bulk for any asymptotically ADS bulk solution which satisfies the weak energy condition and or the generalized second law. Okay, So again, we get the structure we want from the bulk theory. I will pause and say that so far I haven't explicitly be complete this. Everything that I've said sounds well, may sound a formulated level of an effective theory, and so you might wonder if you really need a UV complete theory in the bulk. I think you probably do, because in my argument, what I want to do is to exponentiate the Hamiltonian. And I really think, as far as I can tell, I need the entire unitary time evolution operator, e to the iht, which, you know, if it's unitary, it gives you the time evolution for all times and in all circumstances. So this suggests that if you have that you're using the UV completeness because you don't want to be held by things like black hole formation or the formation of singularities. At least makes you worry that if you had only an effective theory, you would not be able to define this exponentiated operator in all circumstances to the degree that you need. Maybe I could say this by saying that gravitational collapse, of course, tends to collapse things and therefore naturally turns sort of low energy excitations into things that are higher energy excitations. All right. Well, let's go to the next slide. Okay. That's my of old stories. The purpose of this talk is to, and this work, is to see if we can say thing that would be useful. Okay? So in particular, this equation I wrote down, which talks about how to express boundary values at one time in terms of boundary values of all fields at another time, is sort of elegant and compact. It's just an equation of motion, but it's admittedly rather formal. In particular, as I've just noted, constructing this exponentiated Hamiltonian operator is equivalent to solving solving the full dynamics of the fluid. So this makes you stop and scratch your head and say, all right, I definitely agree that in a natural gravitational theory, an ADM-like Hamiltonian is given by boundary values of bulk fields. And so if I know those boundary values at one time, I sort of know H. But in it ask, is knowledge of H really equivalent to knowledge of the exponential of H? I mean, in many problems, of course, it may be true in principle, but not at a practical level. When I write an arbitrary Hamiltonian for my quantum mechanics students, I can't legitimately expect them to construct the full-time evolution and solve the Schrödinger equation for all times exactly in all contexts.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
Question. This is the ADM Hamiltonian. Are you assuming that you have solved the constraints, including the Hamiltonian constraints, so that H is expressed as a function of the bulk field?
I'm always working on shells on the constraint surface, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I like to work in a covariant phase space on shell formal. Exactly. Quite true. So let's probe that question a little bit. All right. So there's a question here, and we'd like to find, you know, something concrete to test. So we can ask, what related EFT properties might we ask the bulk to reproduce? And it wasn't clear to me for a long time what to do, but I had a very interesting lengthy correspondence with Bob Wall earlier this year where a concrete suggestion came up. So if you go to the next slide, I'll tell you about that suggestion. Wall's suggestion was to look at a technical property called essential self-adjointness of the Hamiltonian on a natural domain. So I will review this idea for those who don't remember it. Remind you that if indeed you really know a self-adjoint operator, the Hamiltonian, exactly on the entire Hilbert space, then of course you can exponentiate it. You just diagonalize it and work on the basis of energy eigenstates, and it's easy to exponentiate to get the action of H on an energy eigenstate. No problem. On the other hand, given H in some more general way, then because H is unbounded, it would be even in principle impossible to fully determine the exponential. So for example, if I tell you matrix element Hamiltonian in some arbitrary basis, or even I give you the action of H in some general dense domain, okay, so that every vector in the open space is a limit of vectors in that domain, that, it turns out, is still not necessarily enough information to determine the exponential. Okay? And it's because unbounded operators like H that have high energy behavior aren't continuous, so you can't just take limits of H on general itself. All right, let's go to the next slide to remind you of a simple example. A simple example occurs for quantum mechanics, say in a one-dimensional box. Let the Hamiltonian be p squared over 2m or minus the Laplacian, then there's a dense set of functions in the Hilbert space, which are just functions that vanish in some neighborhood of the walls, where giving you all the information needed to evaluate the action of H. These are dense, you make basis out of them in the one. But we know that this is not enough information yet to determine the full time evolution under the Schrödinger equation, because we know that in a box we need boundary conditions. I can tell you whether or not the wave function satisfies Dirichlet boundary conditions, or Neumann, or periodic, or what have you. And the technical language to describe this is that on the given domain of smooth functions, the Hamiltonian I described is symmetric, but not self-adjoint. In this particular case, you can specify additional data that tells you how H acts on even larger domains in the Hilbert space, which make H self-adjoint. But in this case, as you need extra boundary conditions, the extension is not unique. There's more than one of them. In the particular case where there is a unique self-adjoint extension, we submit H is essentially self-adjoint. All right. So, questions about this particular slide before I get back to holography? Great, you all know that. Let's go to the next slide then and ask, what does this have to do with holography? So, let's think about the dual conformal field theory. Then, as we said before, the space-like Wilson loops are a set of operators. So it seems reasonable to consider the following dense domain in the CFT Hilbert space. Take the CFT vacuum state and act on all space-like Wilson loops that lie near some constant surface. So let's say they can wiggle back and forth as much as they like, but we're going to restrict them to lie within a thin band of time. Between some T1 and T2, it might be arbitrarily small. Okay, then, you know, because it's a complete set of operators, it is reasonable to expect that Hamiltonian for CFT is essentially self-adjoint on this domain. That is to say, it's reasonable to expect that this domain contains enough information captures enough information from the Hamiltonian to uniquely determine the time evolution. Now, that's an I don't know how to get that result. Bob Wall doesn't have to prove that result, but we both agreed it was a reasonable property to expect. So I'm going to hope that you agree with us and move on. All right. Let's go to the next slide. What I want to do in this talk is to analyze the corresponding bulk question, or a corresponding bulk question, where I can, in fact, prove to you what the answer is. And the bulk question goes like this. Let's again vacuum theory, and let's act on it with the rescaled boundary values of all local bulk fields, it, again, restricted to lie in some thin slice of time. So I can go to an arbitrary point on the boundary, but only within this narrow band of time. And I want to ask, is it true that the bulk Hamiltonian is essentially self-adjoint on this domain, no matter how thin I make that time interval? Okay, that's the question I want to analyze. And the answer I'm tell you is that it's true. The Ball constraint is, the Ball Hamiltonian is essentially self-adjoint on this domain. And interestingly enough, this particular property does not even require us to use gravity. Okay, so just to repeat, this is essentially a question of, do the boundary values of the bulk fields contain enough information to determine the boundary values of bulk fields at all times in the future? We're asking, can we uniquely exponentiate the Hamiltonian? Some kind of gravity is being used to write the Hamiltonian as boundary to claim that you can find the Hamiltonian from the boundary values of the bulk fields. But beyond that, I'm not going to use gravity. Once I have an excuse to consider the Hamiltonian as limits of boundary values of bulk fields, I'm going to use the bulk representation, where I write it as an integral over the bulk, in order to prove this essential self-adjointness property, and gravity will no longer play a role. Okay. Any questions about what I want to do or why I want to do it? Great. Next slide. All right. Idea of how the proof works. I've repeated my bulk. The first part of this slide just states the bulk questions. We can keep track of it. Here's my domain. I'm asking if H is essentially self-adjoint in this domain. To explain some idea of how this is possible, let me start with a warm-up question. Okay? The warm-up question is just take the domain I've specified, the vacuum, act on it with boundary values of bulk fields nearest the one time, and ask, is this set of states even dense in the Hilbert space? In order for H to be essentially self-adjoint on this domain, it must be dense. This is an important question to answer first. And at first, you might think the answer is no. You might say, how can this domain possibly be dense? We're only disturbing the vacuum at the boundary. We're not doing anything to it in the integrator. However, a fairly well-known quantum field theory called the Riesz-Schlieder theorem, which says that, in fact, this domain is. In fact, it says stronger. It says, if you pick the vacuum state, and pick any one point anywhere in the space-time, and then act on the vacuum with local operators that are in some arbitrarily small neighborhood of that one point, which I've called P here, that those the states you generate are, in fact, dense in the Hilbert space. And in fact, you don't even have to go out from the point P in all directions. You could just use a tiny infinitesimal. You could just use a tiny infinitesimal time-like GD for P is in fact enough. Okay, so dense is hard to prove. It follows from Riesz-Schlieder. This fact, which is surprising if you haven't seen it before, I should mention, has nothing to say about causal influences in quantum field theory or the effects of local sources. Those effects are all causal. There's no effect on light propagation. Instead, the Riesz-Schlieder theorem is a result of the strong and highly non-local entanglement that is present in the vacuum of any quantum field theory, or in fact, in any other quantum field theory state called bounded energy, meaning that it has zero components along the high energy parts of the Hamiltonian. I should also mention that if you want to actually do this in practice, and if you're working near this point, if you want to control the properties of the state to get far away, it can work really hard. It's kind of, for a massive theory, at least it's exponentially hard in the distance between the point you're working which you want to control. All right.
Question?
Great.
Yes. But you're working in the kernel of the Hamiltonian constraint of a quantum gravity theory, which has a very different notion of locality. So do you know that this theorem applies in the context of the kernel of the Hamiltonian?
When I say that I prove this result in the bulk, what I actually mean is I'm going to prove it in a free version of the bulk theory and then suggest that the same thing works at all orders in perturbation theory. That's what I'm actually going to do.
Okay, so you don't know the answer to the question of what that looks like on the kernel of the Hamiltonian.
So I can treat that perturbatively because I can use it's true in perturbation theory that the Hamiltonian can again be re-expressed as a boundary term, but I do not have any sharp statements about the full non-competitive theory in the book. I'm really talking about investigating this property in a perturbative regime.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Can you comment on what goes into that gray Schneider theorem? I mean, you said it's any quantum field theory, but...
Analyticity.
Analyticity.
Yeah, it's a simple consequence of analyticity.
Okay.
I'd have to think for a minute to put the words in the right order, but it follows from the statement that any analytic function which vanishes, you know, in an open set vanishes everywhere. So it's really related. So in that sense, it really is something we expect to hold even non-perturbatively in quantum field theories. It follows from the positive energy structure of quantum field theories. Good. All right. So let's go to the next slide. As I was just explaining to Lee, what I'm actually going to do, the technical result that I will show you, is that the bulk Hamiltonian is essentially self-point on the domain generated from the vacuum by field boundary values of bulk fields in a free field theory, free scalar field theory in anti-de Sitter space. I presume it's true that for the usual reasons this will extend to perturbatively corrected interacting theories, but I admit that I haven't worked that out in detail, and it's a great exercise for someone to pursue. Now, you might immediately say, all right, didn't you just throw the baby out with the bathwater? If you have a free theory, then there's no sense in which the Hamiltonian is a boundary term. So just to allow us to discuss everything sort of in one go, I will introduce the following toy model, which I call a model of Newtonian gravity. Just some words, okay? Here's the toy model. The actual dynamics is just that of a free, massive, say, scalar field in ADS. So this is the blue part that says, let phi be a free, massive field in ADS with some time-independent boundary conditions that you get to choose. All right. I will then introduce another thing into the... which is actually not new, but just the old phi repackage. Let capital phi be the particular non-local function of little phi defined at each time. So I'm going to break Lorentz covariance in this toy model theory. I'm going to introduce preferred foliation, space-like slices labeled by t. And on each t, I'm going to solve Poisson's equation. Poisson's equation involves the Laplacian on that space-like surface. And I'm going to construct this capital phi by applying the Poisson Dirichlet-Green's function to the energy density rho associated with my bulk Lorentz covariant field little phi. That's equivalent to saying that phi is the capital phi is the solution of the Poisson equation on each constant surface with source given by the energy density. All right. If you do that, then of course you find that due to Gauss's law, the usual bulk Hamiltonian of the massive free scalar field theory can be written as this thing, blue equation at the bottom of the screen, which is formally a boundary term in terms of boundary values of capital phi. This is all just a trick. This theory is really just a massive free scalar in the bulk. I just put some decorations around it to allow me to claim that I have a toy model where H is again a boundary term. It's a cheap trick. The one thing I would mention is that although this is a cheap trick, the structure of this theory is not too different from a model that David Tong recently introduced into ADS CFT using what you might call partially massive gravity, okay, which he argued may be connected to normal CFTs coupled to disorder. So maybe it's not completely crazy that this toy model is more than a toy model in some context. But anyway, it gives me a framework for discussing Hamiltonians as boundary terms and working with a theory that's actually free so I can do some real calculation. Great. Actually, I will never mention the pseudo-Newtonian potential capital phi again. I will just stick to the free massive field because although the Hamiltonian can be written as the boundary term at the bottom of the screen, it can also be written as the bulk and Earl of Earl. And that's it. That's a fine way to represent it from what I'm going to do. All right. So, for the next slide. Good. So now we get the actual technical part of the talk, the part that you may be waiting for and that may put some of you to sleep. So I'm going to proceed kind of iteratively through this. I'll try to start by giving a sketch of proof that the Hamiltonian of my free scalar field theory is self-adjoint on this given domain generated by acting with boundary values of bulk fields on the back. All right. The brief sketch goes like this. I'm going to list the intermediate states in the proof. Okay? So I'm interested in a scalar theory in ADS with some boundary condition. So the Hamiltonian has a discrete spectrum. Since I have already imposed boundary conditions. So there's some discrete set of energy eigenstates, an infinite family of those. Now, suppose I can show you that for each energy eigenstate, there is a sequence of approximations I've called psi n of e, which lie in my domain, which have the following two properties. Property one is just that the psi n's approximate the energy eigenstate in the Hilbert space norm, so the psi n's converge to E in the Hilbert space topology. The other is the statement, property two, that if you compute expectation value in psi n of H minus E squared, that's zero. So that means that this is a pretty good approximation of the energy eigenstate. Okay, it's a pretty good approximation. If you like the fluctuations in the energy are going to zero. Okay. If I can show two properties hold, then it follows that the Hamiltonian is essentially self-adjoint on my domain. Or said equivalently, it follows that any self-adjoint operator H tilde that agrees on my domain, the given operator H, is in fact equal, H tilde equals H, on every state of the Hilbert space where both operators are well defined. In particular, they have the same eigenstates and the same eigenvalues. So if I can show you that 1 and 2 hold, it means my domain D is big enough that it already knows about any possible boundary conditions we might need to impose on the Hamiltonian. All right. Let's go to the next slide where I'm going to explain what I just said in case it wasn't obvious. Okay. So, how do I prove that 1 and 2 imply essential self-adjointness? Well, the point is that if we suppose there's a self-adjoint H tilde that agrees on D with H, well, that means that in equation 2, I can replace H by H tilde, since that equation works just in D. So that gives me equation star. It's in black about two-thirds of the way down. Okay? Just replacing H by H tilde in equation 2. Now, what I want to do is rewrite that equation after decomposing the psi n's in terms of a complete set of eigenstates of H tilde. I'm assuming that there's some self-adjoint H tilde, so it has a complete set of eigenvectors, which I'll call E tilde. Okay, so in the bottom part of this, I'm just going to decompose each psi n as a sum over E tildes, and then insert that decomposition into equation star. The result is the sum over E tildes of E minus E tildes. The E tildes come from the H tilde in star, and the E was already there. It's E minus E tilde squared times, of course, the squared component of each psi n along the given E tilde. Okay, so this is a sum of positive definite quantities, which property 2 claims go to zero in the n goes to infinity limit. In here, just labeling my approximations to the energy eigenstate. So it's a sum of positive definite quantities, so it must be that each term vanishes separately. Okay? So that tells me that these components, psi n, in the along E tilde, in the approximation E, must vanish unless E equals E tilde. Right? On the other hand, property one, that the psi n's approximate E, and the fact that the E tildes are normalized, because I assume that the first simplicity of notation anyway, that H tilde is a discrete spectrum. We can work with you a spectrum case if you want to. Case where E tilde is a normalized state, E tilde is a continuous functional on the Hilbert space, and therefore it follows that these psi n of E tildes actually converge to a matrix element in E tilde and E. So since the length of the psi n's is 0 only for E equals E tilde, it follows that these matrix elements between E tilde and E are also non-zero only between E tilde and E. But since E's and E tildes are all normalized states, it must mean that they're essentially Kronecker delta. So we conclude two operators, H and H tilde, have the same eigenstates and the same eigenvalues, and so they're the same operator. All right. So, question about this. This is the proof that if I show 1 and 2, then I'm done. Great. Let's go to the next slide. So how am I going to show 1 and 2? The top bit of the slide, the black part and the first blue part, just reminds you what I'm trying to do. How am I going to do it? Well, the idea, as in the second black part there, is to, I'm going to work with a linear field, so I'll expand it in spherical harmonics and work separately with each spherical harmonic, which I've written down in some notation for general dimensions. Then, of course, I'm going to Fourier transform in the time direction. And, of course, the idea is to find functions of time that supported in my arbitrarily small window such that the given function state shown here in black, which is just taking my boundary operators and sort of smearing them in the time direction with this test function, approximates the desired energy eigenstate. Now, this is a place to discuss what looks like the obvious problem with this rough general idea that was probably obvious to start with. The obvious problem is that it looks like we need to find functions gn, which are somehow supported in a tiny window in time, and it looks like we're also trying to make them sharply peaked in frequency space, because we're trying to get them to produce a state of a very definite energy. Okay. It turns out that's not, we can get by with much weaker. That, of course, would be possible. If G is sharply peaked in time, then G tilde must be very broad in some energy space. But the key point that makes this argument work is that we're applying these operators to the vacuum, which of course is annihilated by any negative frequency part of beta. Okay. So we can allow the beta operator, we can allow Gn to have huge negative frequency tails. Well, I shouldn't call them huge negative frequency parts, but they won't have any, they won't cause any trouble. They'll just give us zero. They'll go away. In fact, as long as any piece of G which corresponds to a frequency smaller than the frequency of the lowest state for the given angular momentum will similarly annihilate the vacuum and just go away. Just around this apparent conflict with the uncertainty principle, the usual delta E, delta T is less than 1. All right, some general words about how we're going to do this, about why this can work. Of course, since we're looking at free theory, I'll start with single particle states. In fact, as may be obvious at this point, I'm going to do the lowest energy state in each given angular momentum sector first, and then once I show you how that works, the higher states, the multi-particle states all work basically the same way, and I'm not going to bother you with these. All right, so we're going to work on just sort of the lowest one particle state in each sector. All right, go to the next slide. I think I have time to actually show you how this works. Okay, so again, I've just reminded us of what we're trying to do. I want to show these two properties for a particular set of states, and in order to specify what those states are, I need to tell you what is this sense of functions gn I'm going to choose, which gives me tighter and tighter control over the energy of the resulting psi. Yet again, I'm back off a little bit and do a slight warm-up problem. It's actually almost the whole problem. It's a warm-up only in the sense that I'm going to assume that I'm trying to create a one-particle state of zero energy, and then later I'll track up to whatever is the actual desired energy. Okay, so let me just you could think of this warm-up problem as saying, suppose I choose conventions such that the lowest energy state, one particle state in my given quantum sector has zero energy. All right, turn into it. Certainly, the function f0 shown on the screen, which is the characteristic function of an interval, is something I can legitimately consider as a Snellian. Particularly, I want to take my time interval, t1, t2, to just run from some minus epsilon to epsilon, and then this is the characteristic function of that interval, whose Fourier transform, I'm sure you all know, it's a sine of omega epsilon divided by omega. As a reminder, even though f0 is not smooth, it is continuous, the fact that it's bounded and compactly supported means the Fourier transform is smooth. The discontinuity shows up only through the relatively large ultraviolet tail of f0, and it decreases only like 1 over omega, not faster. Okay, I want to start with that function, and I want to, that of course has some Fourier transform that you can see here. It clearly is not going to give me something that's well focused on zero energy. But I want to refine it through a series of steps that kills off the positive frequency part at the expense of growing the negative frequency part, which I've already said is not going to hurt me at all. The iterative perception I want to use is at the bottom of the screen, where the proportionality just means there's a normalization constant I haven't included. So what do I want to do? I want to take the n minus first function, multiply it by an oscillatory exponential, integrate that from minus infinity to t, and then multiply by another oscillatory exponential. So what does that do? Well, I'll go through it in various stages, but let's first note that f a function, we want the result to be a function that vanishes except in the interval minus epsilon to epsilon. It is manifest from the formula that the function vanishes for t less than minus epsilon, that is to say, in the past. Because if t is less than minus epsilon, and t prime is less than minus epsilon, so the fn and the integrand is zero. Okay. It is also manifest in the formula that for t greater than epsilon, the future of my interval, this fn is a constant. Because again, the integrand vanishes for t prime greater than epsilon, assuming I've shown that fn minus 1 is already supported in my interval. So it's some constant. Which constant is it? Well, it's obvious. The constant is obviously given by just integrating the integrand from minus infinity to infinity. In other words, it's a certain Fourier component of f. Which Fourier component is it? Well, it's the Fourier component that lives at minus pi n over epsilon, i.e. it's exactly where I put, where you can see that there are zeros to the left of the origin in the Fourier transform f0. Okay. So I'm going to convince you in a moment that those zeros, or at least the right subset of them, persist when I apply the transformation, so that, in fact, what I've then argued is that to the future of my interval, the new function also vanishes. So I get, that's what it says at the bottom. This function vanishes into the future of the interval due to the zero of, it should be the zero of the Fourier transform of fn minus 1 at omega equals minus n over epsilon. And you may be somewhat dismayed that I chose a discontinuous function to start with, but since I integrated at every step and I went to this infinitely many times, the function gets smoother and smoother. It's never technically C infinity, but it's very, very smooth at high end. I could work with pretty smooth functions if you wanted, but then I couldn't give you as explicit one. All right. So the key question is, what does this transformation look like in Fourier space? Well, let me say it in words before I write down the formula. In Fourier space, the first multiplication by an oscillatory exponential is just a translation in Fourier space. The integral, of course, is multiplying by 1 over omega in Fourier space. Then I do another translation in Fourier space. So if we go to the next slide, which is identical to this one except the bottom formula, this is what it adds up to. The next function is given in terms of the previous function by just dividing by this factor. This is 1 over omega times the previous function after a conjugation, or after a translation, after a conjugation by a translation. So it's sort of 1 over omega, but where the pole is not at 0, it's at whatever, the pi n over epsilon. All right. So this is what this problem amounts to. And as you can see, what happens is that at each step, I introduce what looks like a pole in the denominator, but that pole exactly cancels one of the zeros present in the original Fourier transform F0. So each of the zeros to the left of the origin, it's only the ones at negative frequency that get canceled. Each of the zeros to the left of the origin get canceled one by one by one by one by one. What you can also see is that the factor I'm multiplying by is designed to, or the factor I'm dividing by is designed to be just one when omega equals zero. So at zero frequency, nothing is happening. The Fn's are equal to all the Fn minus 1's, or Fn equals Fn minus 1 at zero frequency. On the other hand, at positive frequency, obviously we're reducing the height of the Fourier transform. And at negative frequency, we're increasing the height. So as a visual representation, if we go to the next, this is F0, the next slide shows you a picture of the Fourier transform F1, and the next slide after that shows you a kind of picture of the Fourier transform of F2. Okay. This is what's happening. We're squashing the positive frequency components, we're not changing them to zero frequency, and we're letting the negative frequency components become very large in a way that actually annihilates more and more zeros as we go out. All right. So that's what we want to do. That's how I make a function that would do nice things at one at a zero energy state. To work with the actual problem, all I have to do is choose my gn's, but I want to put it into this red formula at the top of the slide, to be given by an oscillatory exponential times these fn's. I just have to shift the whole story over to where it's not the zero frequency part I'm holding constant, but it's the part that relates to the frequency of the lowest state at a given angular momentum. And again, yes, that means that G has parts in its Fourier transform that grow at each step, but since these are all annihilating the vacuum state, they don't matter. This is giving me a state which exactly the property I want, that it's going to focus more and more on a given energy at higher and higher n. And the fact that it works at the technical levels of 1 and 2 follow from the fact that these tails in the high energy direction are suppressed by arbitrary powers of omega at high n. So this is enough to show that 1 and 2 hold. Right. So, well, the good news is that I'm basically done, which is, if we go to the next slide, that's what it says. I just maintain that if you believe that proof, if you follow that, you can do the same thing for the higher states. You can do the same thing for higher states either by putting in zeros in your function at each lower energy state so that you don't mess with them, or just at each stage by subtracting off pieces of the lower energy states you've already made. So in the usual way, once you've done the first case, the others follow kind of similarly, and you can also do this in the multi-particle case. So what the text read here says, it just summarizes that I've done what I want to do. This argument, if you follow the technical details, shows that in this simple toy model, the Hamiltonian isn't, or if you like, for a free scalar field in anti-de Sitter space, it's true that the Hamiltonian is essentially self-adjoint on the domain generated from the vacuum by acting only with the rescaled boundary values of bulk fields in some thin, arbitrarily thin slice of time on the boundary. And the point, as I said before, is this mirrors what at least Bob and Wald and I thought were natural expectations for how the CFT should behave, and so provides another sort of check that this story is reasonable. All right. Final slide is just my little summary. So what I did today was to review arguments that it's the Gauss law, the bulk gravitational theory, which is sort of the critical feature to having a self-contained holographic dual theory, having a dual theory with its own time evolution that tells data how to go from one slice to another. This suggests that strings in the known example are perhaps not doing a whole lot to enact cryptography, aside from providing the all-important UV completion of gravity in the ball. It also suggests that, if you have a good UV complete theory of gravity, which doesn't have strings, that as long as Hamiltonian is also a boundary term on shell, you will again have some decent dual CFT. Whether or not dual CFT has a Lagrangian formalism is a different question. And I think it's an interesting question to pursue whether or not the strings that arise in string theory, you know, might be critical in getting what we think of as simple dual field theories, where simple might just mean that there admits a Lagrangian formalism at all. All right, what actually did was new was to study a further trick of this idea, which was suggested by a conversation with Bob Wall, which is that we expect the CFT Hamiltonian to be self-adjoint in a certain domain. And what I did, as it says in red, is I confirmed what occurs to be the analogous property in this simple toy model of free fields in the ball. And I think it should work well in curvative model as well. So that's what I have to say. I hope you enjoyed the talk. Thank you.
Really need
the nothing. Means that as far as this toy model part, where it's the showing the self-adjointness of we're showing potential self-adjointness of the bulk Hamiltonian for a free theory, I made it ADS concrete, and in the paper give some details of formulas. It works just as well if you take a time-like cylinder in Minkowski space with a particular boundary. And ADS is playing really no role. You could create a space-time where it failed, I think, because you need, let's see, what exactly is the property you need? In ADS, the rescalings you do with the boundary are power laws, okay? If the rescaling you had to do was exponential to the Fram coordinate, the argument would not go through due to a certain technical step in the middle. But you need the rescaling near the boundary, if there is a rescaling, to sort of not be exponential in the version of the argument given. Otherwise, most anything with a time-like boundary works. So I should just rephrase that. What you needed in this story is a time-like boundary. I have not thought about whether you could do this, say, at space-like infinity in Minkowski space. That would be an interesting question to look at.
Can you maybe make a comment if you think of non-string UV completions for gravity? Are there any properties that would make your story not go through?
Again, so long as there exists a Hamiltonian operator, which is in some sense a boundary term on the shell, it should go through. If you have a UV complete theory of quantum gravity, but that's not the case. And I know that, for example, Raphael Sorkin tells me that he believes that causal sets for client sets, then this argument is not good.
Further questions or comments?
When you're talking about holography, you're talking in some very general sense. Like at the end, you were asking this question, well, is the boundary theory described by some Lagrangian?
Correct.
So, yeah, I don't know. That's just, I don't know. That just struck me as, even if the theory is holographic, but the boundary theory is non-local, or can you say anything about the structure of the?
So let's go back for a second, okay? I'm interested in I'm really interested in cases where the dual theory is at least local. But of course, there are local even conformal field theories which are not described by a Lagrangian, right? This was the 2-0 theory in six dimensions or something like that. That's what I had in mind. And again, right, so let's talk about that. They're actually good. My reply to Astrid's question was, what is needed for the dual CFT to have a Hamiltonian? That's really just that the bulk theory has a Hamiltonian, which is a boundary term homogeneity. If you want, and as Rob and I agree is a natural thing to ask, that the dual theory actually be local, you may need a bit more. The property that I think we need is a quantum distinction Gao-Wall result. You need it to be true that the commutator of any two operators on the boundary vanishes its separation. That's one definition of local. And as I say, semi-classically, that will be true for a theory of gravity due to Gao-Wald or the Aaron-Wall result. But that's an interesting question, whether or not in some non-perturbative UV complete non-stringy version of the bulk, it persists. You could imagine that it fails somehow, in which case the commutators of the dual theory wouldn't vanish in space like that. Another part of locality, of course, is the existence of a stress tensor for the CFT, but that will follow by the Witten argument if your bulk theory is gravitational and if it allows you to compute the response to if it allows you to choose boundary conditions arbitrarily. If you can change the boundary metric at the edge of ADS, anything you like, you will certainly have a CFT. Maybe those are two other comments that complete this set of questions.
You also commented early on that the strings in the models we know, that the strings and the brains give us non-local objects in the boundary theory.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if those, I don't know, are your construction seems to focus entirely on local operators. Are non-local objects somehow, could they be an essential feature of consistent theory? Or somehow, it's just in many theories that people are talking about outside the context of holography, defects and then extended objects are now playing a bigger and bigger role.
It's a great question. Okay, it's a natural question. All I can say is, in the context of what I've been saying here, I don't see a truly essential role for those things in this holographic correspondence. Let me just say this a little more explicitly. If we go back to, let me see, slide number, if you can go to slide number 9. That will do the third purpose. Let me know when you're there. In this way of thinking, if there are non-local objects in the theory, you kind of get this way of thinking, meaning that big equation at the top, this Heisenberg evolution equation, if there are non-local objects in the theory, or if there are interesting non-local operators in a dual CFT, well, you know, they're things that mix with the local operators under time evolution. So the right-hand side of this expression already, in some sense, contains all the information about those non-local objects, but I didn't need to explicitly refer to those non-local objects in writing it down or in telling my story. So at the level discussed here, I don't see an explicit role for those non-local objects, but perhaps there is. And as I say, it seems to me the place to look is in trying to understand whether those non-local objects would give you a theory that is in some sense simpler than the theory with. And it's related to what I call this quantum extension of the Gao-Wald result in the bulk. Maybe it's related in the end to vanishing of space-like commutators in the field theory. I don't know how to explore that. That's a good question.
If there are no further questions, let's thank Tom very much again.